T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network, from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with 3 lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.
KMOX.
Listen anytime, anywhere.
Get the radio.com app today.
Mr. Trump has magic about him.
This is the greatest country in the world, but we do have some really stupid people.
How can I describe our leaders better than the word stupid?
This guy has magic coming out his ears.
This is the most unethical sham.
So in the words of my late friend Aretha Franklin, show some R-E-S-P-I-C-T.
Now, Mark Reardon.
I've never known a guy more talented at untangling politics so that anyone can understand.
On KMOX.
I got a message last week from a listener who heard Al Sharpton. I guess they did not know that Al Sharpton was in the soundbite at the show open there that we use. You know, there's a couple of different show opens, and that's one that features his spelling of R-E-S-P-E-C-T, which is R-E-S-P-I-C-T. And the listener said, hey, don't know if you know this, but he misspells that word. And yes, we thank you for the attention to detail. But we knew that, and that's one of the reasons that we feature that. I'm actually accused that the social justice warriors at the Post-Dispatch or somewhere else haven't cited me for racism for just simply playing that soundbite. Now that I've said that, they probably will. So we'll see what happens. Happy President's Day, ladies and gentlemen. Who's working today? Like, I think only the people in this building. It used to be President's Day, at least from my perspective, wasn't a holiday for everyone, but it is this year. Schools, banks, post office, and a lot of businesses. But we are here, ladies and gentlemen, and there's a lot to catch up on from the weekend. I do have some fun stuff coming up this afternoon, including, I'm looking forward to this, because there was a list that came out last week from this group called the Young Americas Foundation. Spencer Brown's going to join me this afternoon. They put a list together of the most bizarre and politically correct college courses that are offered around the country. And some of them are quite stunning, like Marx for Today or Queering Childhood or American Misogyny. All of these at real universities across the country, which will probably not surprise a lot of people. Doug High, one of our political go-to guys inside the swamp, is going to, inside the Beltway, I should say, you know, in the swamp, is going to join us this afternoon. He's a former communications director for the RNC. We got a bunch of other stuff going on, plus an audio cut of the day right into Total Information PM. But let's start with our good buddy Jesse Smollett from Empire, gay and black and the victim of a hate crime when two Trump supporters beat him up a couple of weeks ago in Chicago. Although it seems like nothing he said originally was true about this case whatsoever. And it certainly fell apart over the weekend. Rafer Weigel back with us. He spent a little time here in St. Louis at Fox 2, is now at Fox 32 in Chicago. He's off today, so I appreciate him contributing and bringing us up to speed. Rafer, how are you?
I'm fine, Mark. How are you doing, sir?
I'm good. We spoke on Thursday afternoon, but a lot has happened since then, hasn't it?
Oh, yeah. Well, the two persons of interest that police were questioned, they threatened them with charging them with battery. So our sources tell us they essentially flipped. They told police that Jesse Smollett paid them to orchestrate the entire charade, or whatever you want to call it. And police were able to nail these guys based on the video records, Lyft receipts. They were able to see exactly where they traveled to so they could track down where they live. And according to police sources, they still had the receipt for the rope that was found around Jesse Smollett's neck. So at this point, police are wanting Smollett to come in voluntarily to be questioned, but his lawyers are giving zero indication that they plan on doing that anytime soon. In the meantime, Smollett, his first lawyer, and he parted ways. We don't know if it was because, you know, he was fired by the lawyer. My sources are telling me that the former lawyer, Michael Monaco, who represents Michael Cohen, did not want him to come out with a strong statement and therefore didn't think that they could work together. So we got a new legal team. He's got a crisis management team in place, a woman named Ann Cavanaugh in Chicago, former reporter at Fox 32, and a new legal team. And they're essentially circling the wagon. So there's been a lot of reports out there about the potential of a grand jury. The TMZ has reported that. That is very premature. So the only way that that would happen is if Smollett does not come in on his own volition, if he doesn't come in voluntarily. And that would be kind of a last resort that police would do to finally get him in front of detectives to be questioned for all of this.
So I was a little surprised, going back to the new legal team, the statement they released over the weekend, it was pretty defiant. I mean, they didn't back down at all, did they?
No, he's doubling down, he's tripling down. I will say that Chicago police are a little upset with some of the leaks that have come out, because now Jesse Smollett can prepare his questioning. He knows what they're going to ask him. And, you know, the things about the two guys being paid, you know, that was leaked out by detectives on the inside. Police aren't happy about that, because now Smollett's legal team, they're not denying that these guys attacked him, but they're now going to say it was a random attack. At least that's what I'm gathering from the statement from the new legal team, a statement that his former lawyer, sources are telling me, was not comfortable making publicly.
Rafer Weigel from Fox 32 in Chicago, who's been briefing us on all this for the past couple of weeks. Let's go to that interview with Robin Roberts from Thursday morning, before all of this broke on Thursday afternoon when we last spoke, because he talked about the guys that were caught on the video and whether or not he believed that those were the guys who attacked him.
The police have gone through a lot of video, and they were able to capture an image of two people of interest. Have you seen that image?
Mm-hmm.
And do you believe that they could possibly be the attackers?
I do.
What is it about their size, or what? Why do you feel that they could possibly be?
Because I was there. For me, when that was released, I was like, okay, we're getting somewhere. I don't have any doubt in my mind that that's them. Never did.
So I thought at one point he said they were white guys, but maybe he did not do that.
So I don't know that he actually said their race. So, but no, I mean, at this point, he's not denying that these two guys attacked him. He's just now apparently denying the circumstances, where he's telling, or he is, his lawyers are going on the record, it seems, with the defense of it was a random attack. He didn't know these guys, or he didn't know it was these guys who knew him. They've said in the statement that he, you know, hired one of them to get him in shape for a music video. So at least, you know, acknowledging that money did change hands. So it doesn't appear he's going to go that route. So, I mean, the defense team's kind of played their hand a little bit with the last statement. And now, you know, PD just want him to come in and, you know, look, more than likely Smollett knows he's going to be arrested. He's still not considered a offender at this point, but he, you know, as the police said, they've switched their trajectory. So it stands to reason that when Smollett comes in, he will probably be arrested, and he knows that. So the question is going to be, will he do it voluntarily, or will he make police issue a warrant for his arrest? And, you know, the police have told me they have no indication that Smollett plans on coming in anytime soon. So, you know, they don't know how long they will wait. You know, a couple days, a week, not sure.
Yeah, it seems like this thing is still going to linger out there for a little while and not have a quick resolution, despite, you know, the new layers here. So, and, you know, I think you mentioned this last week, Rafer, but when all is said and done here, there's some pretty amazing detective work going on, isn't there?
You do have to give it up for the Chicago Police Department. They, you know, I mean, they combed through hundreds of hours of video. They were able to track these two guys down, even with the alleged attack not being caught on video, which, based on what I heard Smollett say in the GMA interview, you know, he said, I didn't know that the video camera was pointed the wrong direction. Well, my question to that was, why would he know there was a video camera if he was being attacked and, you know, basically ran off? So, you know, the attack was not caught on camera. And, you know, allegations are that was his intention, that he wanted this attack to be caught on camera, and the camera wasn't even, quote-unquote, pointing in the right direction.
Oh,
quote him.
I get
and
you.
So, but they did get these guys walking to and from the scene on various surveillance pictures, and then through rideshare lifts, they were able to track them down. And, you know, according to police, these two guys left town hours after the alleged attack to go to Nigeria for a couple weeks, and when they landed at O'Hare Airport, Chicago police detectives were waiting for them and immediately took them into custody. They've done a really good job of slow rolling this. You know, I mean, I think if Smollett knew what they had, I doubt he would have done the GMA interview. His rep certainly would have advised against it, I would think. And but unfortunately, not unfortunately, I shouldn't say unfortunately, but Chicago police say that his interview at GMA cannot be used as evidence. The only thing they can use as evidence is what he tells them directly. And unfortunately, because so much has gone out there publicly, you know, it'll be harder, yeah. I think, for them to catch him in a lie now. Whereas if before they didn't, he didn't know what they had, you know, they probably could have gotten him on you know, perjury. Or it's still right now it's going to be Smollett's word against these two guys. Is what it seems like going forward.
Yeah, and that seems hard. If you're going to have that, I think it would be difficult, and there could be a lot of other things that we don't know about that they haven't leaked, but it would be difficult to get a conviction on, you know, a fake police report if it's a he said, I think.
Yes, and so right now, you know, legal experts that I've spoken to, and again, this is speculation, you know, it would be unlikely that State's Attorney Kim Fox would want to prosecute this felony court. You know, she likes to take on cases that she can win. The guess would be that they would offer him a misdemeanor charge and get him to plead guilty to that and then give him a slap on the wrist. And the question will be, will he take it? You know, my people I know who know Smollett say, you know, he wants to, you know, fight this all the way until the end to vindicate himself. Well, if that happens and it goes to felony court, he could be looking at prison time. So, no, I don't see any quick resolution to this. I spoke to the crisis manager earlier today, even though I'm on vacation with my son in Las Vegas. Who's sitting patiently watching me do this interview right now. Then she said there will be they have no plans to go in and talk to Chicago PD anytime soon. So we're in a holding pattern.
I guess. Ray Ferwago, back to the kids and, you know, shoot for number 11 on the roulette table. That's my advice for you there.
Okay, Mark, I appreciate it. Thanks,
I appreciate
guys.
All the help. Thanks, Rafer. So one of the things that he said there, and I pulled the audio up, was very interesting to me. Let's go back to Robin Robertson, what he said about the camera in that, you know, the vicinity of the attack.
And I looked up and I saw that there was a camera directly on the light post that is in the intersection. So I'm like, there it is. And then the detective told me that the camera inside of the casing was facing north. So they didn't have it. And that was disappointing.
So I wasn't thinking about it from that perspective until that interview where he clearly wanted it to be caught on camera. He even said during the interview, he goes, I want people to see that I fought back, because he says he fought back with those guys. Anyway, that whole saga is not concluded yet. We'll keep track of it. And I appreciate Rafer Weigel for doing such a great job here the past couple of weeks.
It's more than just a conversation. It's your voice with Mark Reardon on the Voice of St. Louis, KMOX.
I think we almost need a special feature. Maybe we're just going to debut it here this afternoon. The silly, stupid, hilarious things that AOC says. Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, like this one here.
No matter how you feel about the law, you know, I think it's a moral abomination. I think it's like the Berlin Wall.
You kind of wonder if she knows that the Berlin Wall was built to stop East Germans from escaping into West Germany, as opposed to keeping illegal immigrants and drug traffickers and human traffickers out of this country. I'm fascinated by our new rock star. It's 2:22. I know Doug High is probably fascinated by her, too. Gives us a lot of material. CNN political contributor, former comms director for the RNC. Doug, how are you?
It's good to be with you. I don't think that you could expand your show long enough to contain all of the crazy things that he says on a daily basis. You'd have to go 5-6 hours a day.
You know, but I talked about this last week, and I can't remember who wrote the column. At least she owns what she's saying. You know, it's a bunch of nonsense, but some of the other folks in her party that, well, they won't criticize her, or they won't own up to some of the, you know, the silliness, that's where I think I would have the bigger problem.
Yeah, look, she has a huge following. She has more than 10 million Twitter followers. For somebody who has been a member of Congress for about 2 months, that is an insanely high number. That's a huge number if you've been in Congress for 20 years. And so she has power, and I think, you know, her colleagues know it, and that's one of the reasons that they are declining to be critical of her.
You know, the thing with what happened in New York and Amazon, too, and I didn't say this last week, but there are conservatives. I think the Wall Street Journal is opposed to the subsidies, and there have been some columns. Show Me Institute here in St. Louis, Patrick Ismail, who's been a guest on my show, wrote a piece that pretty much, you know, criticized the subsidies as well. So that's strange bedfellows, isn't it? I mean, obviously, she went a little bit further than that, but when it comes to the subsidies, there was agreement on the right as well.
There was, but the agreement was also for different reasons. You know, hers was more of an anti-business, we don't want your jobs, where the Wall Street Journal and others we're really arguing about what the government's role here was. And so, you know, there are some comparisons too, as we see all the time. Whenever a sports franchise either wants to move to a new city or build a new arena or stadium, you know, the local government, state governments get involved pretty heavily. And that's something that also brings, you know, left and right together quite often.
All right. So I want to get to the Andrew McCabe interview in just a second. Let's stick on immigration, the wall, the national emergency, all these things. I mean, I'm not in the camp that is a fan of what the president's doing. I think he sort of got his butt kicked here by Nancy Pelosi, and the national emergency route is a dangerous precedent moving forward. Chris Wallace challenged Stephen Miller about this yesterday on his show on Fox. But where does Doug High stand right now, and what the president did and the way this all wrapped up, leading to, or I guess averting, another government shutdown?
Yeah, you know, I think a few things bothered me on this. One, I thought it was an opportunity for the president to declare victory and walk away. He did get funding for a wall, and, you know, he moved the Democrats towards his side. And I think, you know, regardless of how much of a victory it was or how much the funding was, the president could have gone out and credibly said that he caused the Democrats to support wall funding and then let the Democrats argue amongst themselves. But to not really take the deal and declare it as a victory, I think, is a problem. And the only reason he didn't, obviously, was the shutdown caused real pain for the administration and clearly would have caused more pain if it had happened yet again. And then the action on the emergency declaration. I think when you, A, are threatening to declare an emergency for well over a month, it's probably not an emergency. And when you state when you state in the Rose Garden, I didn't need to do this, well, then it's also not an emergency.
Yeah, that part, you know, right?
And I would caution my conservative friends. You know, we've seen this with Obama when he did this in 2014 on immigration. And obviously, we had real problems with, and I certainly had real problems with, his executive overreach. Just because it's our side doing it, I don't think makes it any better. And also further enables Democrats who are really learning from Trump's tactics. AOC and her attacks on the media is a good example. It tells that next president, that next Democratic president, if you want to declare an emergency on guns or on climate, you've got a green light to do so.
Yeah, you know who else was highly critical of President Obama's overreach on executive powers? Donald J. Trump.
Trump
tweeted about it a lot.
Mike Pence. A lot of them. And, you know, ultimately, you know, and this gets into the less sexy issues of politics, but, you know, where people stand on executive power versus the primacy of Congress and how that power should be shared and held. And, you know, ultimately, whether it's Republican presidents or Democratic presidents, Congress has ceded a lot of its authority to the administration, to Republican and Democratic administrations. And that, to me, is troubling, regardless of who our president is.
All right. So I'm going to get to some of the tape a little later on this afternoon with the interview last night on 60 Minutes, Andrew McCabe. What was your take on what he's saying? Obviously, some very troubling allegations. But you have Rod Rosenstein saying this didn't happen. We heard this theory that the 25th Amendment issue when it came up was just a joke or it was sarcastic. Hard to tell what to make of this, although I think that there's some serious credibility problems for Andy McCabe.
I think there are as well. And, you know, ultimately, we know that this is, you know, we talk so often about how so many of these interviews that we see are about an audience of one. And the audience of one in this case, we know what Trump's reaction is going to be to this. And then that's obviously what we saw on Twitter. It's not clear to me why McCabe is picking this fight right now, or why Rod Rosenstein is still at DOJ. Frankly, I would have thought that he would have been long gone by now, just given how the president has viewed all of this.
What did you, I before I brought you on here this afternoon, I had Rafer Weigel on from Fox 32 in Chicago, and I don't know if I think you might have tweeted about this a couple of times, the Jussie Smollett case, because this thing is just fascinating, isn't it?
It is. And, you know, it also reminds me to some extent of the Covington school situation.
Oh, yeah, sure.
Where, you know, one of the things I try and do is let's figure out what happened first before we all rush to criticize, condemn, you know. And certainly when somebody says that they were attacked, you're inclined to believe them. But it became an immediate indictment on the administration. I saw actress Ellen Page basically blaming on Colbert's show, basically blaming Mike Pence for this, and AOC and other Democratic candidates were very loud in their
Cory Booker, Kamala Harris, they all were, right.
And, you know, it's because we have this rush to judgment. And ultimately, you know, not only have we seen not a lot of walking back of this, the reality is there won't be apologies coming from this, because you can say, well, this didn't happen, comma, but.
Right.
And for those on the left that want to use moments like this to indict the administration, and as you know, I've been pretty critical about this administration on a lot of things, there's always a reason for them to do so. And so the facts almost don't matter in that case. It's all about emotion.
Yeah, because what you've seen, I think, is some people have scrubbed their Twitter accounts and they've taken some of the supportive of Jesse Smollett condemning the president and Make America Great Again and racism and all these other things. But you're right. They probably will keep quiet when it comes to the accountability in the second part of that. I mean, I understand assuming in a violent crime situation where someone comes and claims they were beaten up and they have a noose around their neck, why you would want to certainly investigate those allegations. But as in the Covington Catholic story, which I think was even more egregious just because there was evidence in front of everyone within 24 hours to see exactly what happened, it hopefully is a bit of a lesson for everyone else out there who's quick to bite on these stories, Doug.
Yeah, absolutely. And I was moved today. My friend Kirsten Powers, who your audience probably knows from CNN, used to be with Fox News, had a long thread on Twitter about this, on, you know, how she's trying to step back and look at things you know, with a different lens because of what we've seen on some of the reactions online and how everyone goes to an extreme place immediately. And I remember the day of the Covington situation, a friend of mine saying, well, I want to be out there immediately on this because we may not be talking about this on that Saturday. We may not be talking about this on Monday. And certainly our attention spans are that short. But I just remember thinking, does your voice really need to be out there on this? And we see so many times where these kinds of things are happening. It's always best to sit back and look twice and let's figure out what really happened before we all rush to judgment.
Yeah,
and we're all guilty of it.
That won't happen. Yeah, no, right. There's accountability all over the place. Doug High, great to have you on. Enjoy the rest of your President's Day. We'll talk soon.
Take care. Thank you.
2:31 at the Voice of St. Louis. I have a great topic coming up here. Spencer Brown, who's with a group called Young Americans Foundation, they went out and they found the most bizarre and politically correct college courses offered nationwide. You will be immensely entertained. Donate your car to Goodwill at MERSGoodwill.org and get a tax deduction. Towing is free. We're back with Spencer after the news. I feel like we're living in an alternative universe with the blues right now. I mean, there's no in-between ground, which makes me a little nervous because you're this red hot and what happens after that. But it's great to have 10 victories in a row. They go for 11 tomorrow night at home. 2:37. I've been looking forward to this. My producer passed this along to me last week, and I said, yeah, we got to do this because I try to highlight things like this whenever I can on my show. We've, of course, been at the forefront of some of the nonsense on college campuses here in Missouri after what happened with the football team and Melissa Click and all that a few years back. So there's a group called Young America's Foundation that has put out a list of the most bizarre and politically correct college courses offered nationwide. And I think you will find these to be quite enlightening, like constitutional difficulties in the age of Trump at Princeton University, which may be one of the more legitimate courses amongst this list, as you'll come to find out. Spencer Brown is with Young America's Foundation. Spencer, how are you?
Hey, I'm doing great. Thank you so much for having me.
Tell me a little bit about the group, first of all.
Yeah, so Young America's Foundation has actually been around since 1960. And basically, we exist to ensure that young people, mainly high school and college students, are exposed to and inspired by conservative ideas, things like limited government, strong national defense, and traditional values. And we do that a couple ways. We have campus lecture programs where we bring people like Ben Shapiro to these liberal schools. We also own President Reagan's ranch home out in Santa Barbara, California, that we take high school students to.
Do you really?
And then we do.
That is awesome. I had no idea. That's very cool.
Yeah, so all that is basically with the goal of reaching these young people with conservative ideas, because as this study that we just put out shows, they definitely don't get it from their classroom professors.
So I don't often always ask a guest this, but how old are you, Spencer?
I'm 25.
Okay, so, you know, I grew up in the age of Reagan and was in high school when I first started sort of coming to terms with my political ideology, and certainly at the University of Missouri when I was a freshman and sophomore. And I remember all the professors there that were ripping on Reagan. Of course, these were in the classes that had nothing to do with politics, so all this bias that occurs at universities goes back many, many decades. But you guys, what, scoured the country here for some of the silly courses that are offered at universities around the country, including the University of Missouri?
That's correct. Yeah, this is actually the 25th year we've done this report. And basically what we do is we go through what would be considered the top institutions in America. So things like the Ivy League schools, the SEC, the Big Ten, the top liberal arts colleges. And we just go through the course catalogs and see what it is that students are actually learning. And as you pointed out, you know, this problem is not necessarily new. But what we see is just the trend sort of towards the insane, where they just take any subject and throw queer or gender or feminist in front of it, and then that becomes a new class.
Here's one that we probably can't highlight all these, but this was 9 on your list. Pomona College, Queering Childhood. This interdisciplinary course examines the figure of the child now and how this fixation is used in politics, law, and medicine to justify continued cultural investment in reproductive heteronormativity and productive able-bodiedness. You can't make that up, can you?
You sure can. And that's the kind of stuff we find just throughout this report. But basically, this whole the theory of intersectionality has just completely taken over these schools, where it's no longer enough to just be part of one class. You need to figure out where in this sort of matrix of oppression, of victim Olympics, you fall. And so they have all these courses that really just serve to divide and divide and divide. And I think we're seeing that, you know, played out not just on college campuses, but probably as a side effect in mainstream politics.
Well, Leah, let's talk about an example. I can tie this in very effectively here with one of the Democratic presidential hopefuls, Kirsten Gillibrand, senator from New York. So she's asked, and it's amazing to me, and Spencer, I know you keep an eye on these things, that the group that has an issue with identity politics and voters that drove them away from their party is fixated still on identity politics. So she's asked whether or not over the weekend she would support federal recognition of a third gender listed on a form, so male, female, and a third designation of X. And she says, oh, yeah, I'd support that for sure. Not a problem with that. So.
Well, it's insane. And I think, you know, I mean, that's arguably a result sort of downstream of the education that these people have been receiving for decades, you know. I think sort of that idea that the gender binary needs to be just completely rejected and you should be able to identify as one of, you know, 75 different options that there may be. But that's something that we see all throughout higher education, whether it be, you know, the first day of class and orientation, they tell all the students to stand up and list their name and their preferred pronouns. It's absurd that, you know, the place where you go to learn and be, you know, challenged in your ideas and learn how to think critically is now basically just a place to go learn how much of a victim you are and by whom have you been victimized.
So you put out in this list, and there's a lot of different things that are cited, but you put out sort of a dirty dozen, and that Pomona College class is on that. You want to highlight some of the other favorites for my listeners here this afternoon?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the really troubling ones that is, again, relevant sort of at the national level right now are the courses that try to make Marx somehow relevant again. So you have courses, the University of Minnesota has a course titled Marx for Today. Princeton University has a course titled Marx in the 21st Century. And basically these courses, if you read the descriptions on them, is suggesting that today's problems, however they're perceived in the United States, could be best addressed through Marxism, which is obviously ludicrous. And Marxism leads to socialism. And if you want to see how that goes, just take a trip to Venezuela. You know, I don't see these schools sponsoring study abroad trips to Venezuela to see what socialism actually is like.
But that would actually be a good idea. That would actually be a very educational trip, wouldn't it?
Maybe we'll have to do a contest, win a trip to Venezuela and tell us how it is. But I think, you know, especially, you know, looking at what's going on, if you look at AOC, she's somebody who's, you know, very recently came out of college from a very liberal institution. And I think the way you see her sort of rolling into Congress and making a name for herself sort of shows that these are the classes that she was indoctrinated with. And even more so, she was never challenged in them. And so that's what we see, where these schools are just full of leftist professors and leftist students that just continue this cycle. And that is where Young America's Foundation's mission, of course, comes in, where we bring in conservatives like Ben Shapiro and Katie Pavlich and all these others to sort of break up that monopoly on ideas that exists and give the conservative point of view at least a hearing for one time.
Here's one of my favorites. This is Middlebury College. I can't remember where that is. Do you know Spencer offhand?
Oh, man.
We'll look it up.
I've been to dozens of these, but yeah.
Greg, look that up. Middlebury College. Just curious here. American Misogyny, which sounds like a band name to me. In this course, we will explore the place of misogyny in the U.S. media and politics. Early topics will include film noir, Cold War, gender, scapegoating, blah, blah, blah. This is my favorite part at the end. Throughout the course, we will consider how discourses of misogyny are inflicted by white, cisgender, ableist, ageist, and class privilege. I think I would probably qualify under all those, right? White, cisgender, ableist, I'm old, ageist, I guess, class privilege, just comes with all that. That's a stunning line in a class description.
Yeah, and I think, you know, like I mentioned before, intersectionality is this idea that every sort of, according to the left, every ding you have on your identity that makes you more or less privileged, rather, is somehow a form of empowerment. So these courses, again, just seek to divide students. And instead of saying, you know, hey, we're all here to learn, they say, we're here to learn, but you over there, you have a harder time learning, so we're going to do this. You have an even harder time learning. You're disadvantaged in society. And what that does is basically tells these students that due to innate qualities, they're somehow disadvantaged and have less of a chance to make it, which obviously runs against everything in the American dream, where, you know, if you have personal responsibility and you're willing to work hard, you can get ahead in this country. But instead, you have these students learning that they're a victim, there's nothing they can do about it, and so they should probably blame somebody with more privilege for being in the situation that they're in. And as it turns out with socialism, you know, make those more privileged people pay for everyone else's stuff.
Why is there so much, there's so much love for Fidel Castro and Che Guevara? Yeah. I mean, you have it in Georgia, University of Georgia, Cuba from Emancipation to Revolution. I think Colin Kaepernick is teaching that course. And at the University of Tennessee, Global Capitalism and Racism, which examines Cuba's social history from the 18th century to the present. Now, look, those are good topics, but I think we know how they're being taught at these universities, and that's where the question mark would come. You know, I make the Colin Kaepernick reference for a reason because, and I don't think this has been focused on enough, Spencer, the reason that I take out after Colin Kaepernick is not because he took a knee and he protested, but because after he did it that first time, he came out in a shirt that basically heaped praise on Castro and Che Guevara. So you got a guy that's criticizing racial and social injustice in this country, heaping praise and paying homage to one of the greatest human rights violators in history.
Absolutely. I mean, easily, you know, one of the greatest mass murderers of the time while they were running around, you know, Cuba and the motorcycle and everything else. You know, this is somebody who in his diaries, if people haven't read them, I encourage people to read them because there's such a clear view into the mind of these people who pursue these ideologies, and talking about how the first time he realized how much he loved the smell of blood and gunpowder and just obviously disgusting things that are not social justice warrior, you know, material at all when you look at the things that they're protesting here. But again, you just have them pushing this sort of heroic status on these people who really should be, along with their ideologies, resigned to the ash heap of history.
So let me ask you one question off topic, just because I'm curious. Because I mentioned, you know, I came of age politically in the early 1980s, and I am a conservative politically. I've been very disappointed with some of the things that Republicans have done over the past 10 years, and certainly the past couple of years, including this president, because I think it's, you know, it runs counter to conservative ideology. So where does a group like Young America's Foundation sort of stand in this day and age in politics currently?
Yeah, well, fortunately, the best thing about working at YAF is we're a 501c3, so we're actually nonpartisan. So we're not about politics. We're about, you know, priorities and ideas.
Ah, that's the safe answer. That is the safe answer, and I understand
that.
So,
yeah, no, absolutely. And so, you know, one of our founders was William F. Buckley. And so, you know, we trace our heritage back to him. And President Reagan was extremely involved with us. He was our honorary national chairman for a number of years and used to host our student conferences at the White House. And so, again, it really is just those core conservative ideas that we seek to advance. And so we always do that over, you know, politics, which, as we see, flip-flops very frequently and is very hard to keep a handle on. But the idea is, those are timeless.
Spencer Brown with Young America's Foundation. We have to give a shout out to Amy Lutz too, because she asked for one on Twitter. So I don't even know who she is, but she said, you better give me a shout out. And you were about to leave this interview without giving Amy a shout out. Shame on you, Spencer.
I sure was. She used to be my boss actually. And then my colleague. So
is she here in St. Louis?
No, out at the Reagan Ranch.
Well, she better know that you're on Cam Wex in St. Louis talking about her. And she was a really good boss, wasn't she?
Yeah, well, we'll see.
All right, take care. I was just teasing. Spencer Brown, Young America's Foundation. Thanks for the listen. Thanks for sharing.
Absolutely.
All right, take care. And here's what's on tap this afternoon, sponsored by Midwest Money. I have some audio that I want to get to here from the Scott Pelley, Andy McCabe interview on 60 Minutes. That's coming up.
News at the top and bottom of the hour, mornings and afternoons. KMOX.
I've already already had a bunch of people that have hit me up either email or Twitter saying, hey, where can we find the list of courses? It's the College Fix is the website. And I have to see here if it's thecollegefix.com. I'm going to tell you here in just a second. We can just Google that because I was trying to figure it out during the break. The College Fix. See, I just want to make sure it's, thecollegefix.com is where you would find that. All right, so you had... See if I want to do the Annie McCabe stuff here or the Stephen Miller. Let's talk about Stephen Miller on with Chris Wallace yesterday and the issue of the emergency declaration going back to the deal that the president cut last week to avoid another government shutdown. So this is Stephen Miller, not to be confused with Annie McCabe. Stephen Miller with Mike Wallace yesterday. Here again. No, it's Chris Wallace referring to his dad. It's Monday. It's a holiday. Give me a break. My mind's not working.
I could do the wall over a longer period of time. I didn't need to do this. But I'd rather do it much faster.
I didn't need to do this. How does that justify a national emergency?
Well, as you know, Chris, we already have 4,000 troops on the border. In light of the national emergency, a decision that was made almost a year ago, as we've seen an increasing number of people crossing the border, as well as increasing violence in Mexico. What the president was saying is that, like past presidents, he could choose to ignore this crisis, choose to ignore this emergency, as others have, but that's not what he's going to do.
Okay, that's a little bit of a parsing of the language there, because clearly when you have a situation where you say, I didn't have to really do this, didn't really want to do it or whatever. It sounds like that's not an emergency. So Wallace goes over some of the facts here.
1.6 million people were stopped crossing the border illegally back in 2000. Less than a quarter that many were caught last year. The government's own numbers show, for all the presidents talk about drugs streaming over the border, 80 to 90% of the cocaine, heroin, and fentanyl seized at the border is seized at ports of entry, not along unfenced areas.
So he went through this list challenging Stephen Miller on the nature of the emergency, whether or not this is even an emergency. And then he went to the issue of the Constitution, because Stephen Miller, constitutional, I don't want to say expert, but certainly someone who adheres to a strict adaptation or interpretation of the Constitution.
In any case, let's talk about the constitutional aspects of this, because I've talked to you over the years. I know that you are a constitutional conservative and you believe the Constitution should be interpreted as written, correct?
Yes.
Okay. Here's Article 1, Section 9, Clause 7 of the Constitution as written. No money shall be drawn from the Treasury but in consequence of appropriations made by law. Isn't what President Trump wants to do a clear violation of what the founders, of what James Madison talked about as giving Congress the power of the purse?
By the way, good question. I mentioned Mike Wallace, and I said this last week. I miss Mike Wallace and his brand of journalism because he was tough. And I knew Mike Wallace was probably a lefty. Maybe he wasn't, though. But he asked tough questions like Chris is asking here, and Miller tries to answer that.
But first of all,
can you find out one case?
You think what you're missing?
I jumped ahead there, because what he does is he challenges him on the nature of the emergency, whether it's an emergency.
Let's talk about national emergencies. National emergencies have been declared 59 times since 1976 when the law was passed, the National Emergencies Act. Can you point to a single instance, even one, where the president asked Congress for money, Congress refused to give him that money, and the president then invoked national emergency powers to get the money?
So that's the question.
Well, first of all,
can you find out one case?
You think what you're missing, Chris, is that the national emergencies don't all have the same authorities and the same justification.
I understand that, but there have been 59. Can you find one case like
this?
This
authority specifically refers to the use of military construction funds. Other emergencies, for example, were declared.
If you want to talk about military constructions, do you know how many times military construction has been invoked as a national emergency?
That one was in
twice.
Right.
Twice. Once by George H.W. Bush during the middle of the Gulf War, and the second time by George W. Bush right after 9/11.
Chris, can you
this
name,
is hardly comparable to either
name,
of those.
So basically, and I got to cut it off here, but he basically asked, Stephen Miller asked Chris Wallace, can you name one thing that is a greater threat right now in this country? Because it's not going on in Iraq, Afghanistan, all these other nations. It's happening right here at the border. Obviously, he's sticking to it. Good questions from Chris Wallace. I'm not in the camp that thinks this was a good idea for reasons already stated, including precedent where a Democrat president is going to probably try to use this in the future.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of four amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get four iPhone 15s on us and four lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of four lines for $25 per line per month with auto pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.